This is Murray Roberts, recorded by Chris Alden Lee at the Bass Club Reunion, Cardiff, on the 11th of June 2010. Murray Roberts.
Well, my name is Murray Roberts, and my date of birth is the 25th of December 1941, and I was born at Stanmore in Middlesex, North London.
And what was your first inkling or brush with the Antarctic? What's your first memory of it?
I think my first memory of it was when I was looking for somewhere to do some experimental work that required a group of people to be shut up in one place for several months so that they could be fed an experimental diet. We tried prisons and monasteries who either had funny diets or you weren't allowed to do things to them. And eventually the Medical Research Council said, well, why don't you try the Antarctic Survey, because the people on the Antarctic bases are totally cut off and they only have the food they take with them, and they desperately want doctors on their bases. So I'm afraid it wasn't a huge desire to go and explore the Antarctic, but looking for a group of experimental people which first got me interested.
So had you read about Scott or seen the film? Or?
Well, I think I had, but it hadn't registered as being a huge desire to go to the Antarctic.
So you were kind of an accidental fit, were you? Or a byproduct fit?
Well, a bit accidental. Became more enthusiastic as time went on.
So tell me what happened. What was the kind of work you wanted to do?
Well, at the time there was considerable interest in the effects of dietary carbohydrates on people's blood lipid levels. It was cholesterol and phospholipids and triglycerides. It was felt that that high levels of these led to a high level of coronary thrombosis and heart problems, and that they might be modified by diet. So, and it was felt by some that it was the common sugar in the diet which was the nigger in the woodpile. So we wanted to feed people on a diet with no sugar in it, but which contained glucose as opposed to sucrose. There were problems with that because glucose is not as sweet as sugar, and to try and make the food palatable, it's not so easy to cook with. And we wanted to so the diet all had to be, and most a lot of food, bread, almost any sauce you can think of, has got sugar in it. So it really needed to be people who had no access to common foods. And so that was the basis of the research, to try and feed these people on a diet for a few months and see if it affected their blood lipid levels.
And you approached, or the British Antarctic Survey was approached with the idea of you going down there?
Well, I approached them and they said, yes, we do want medical officers. So I applied to become a medical officer, and we almost require our medical officers to have a research programme because there's no medical work for them to do, or very little.
So you knew first aid and basic physiology and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a happily qualified junior doctor, so...
Right, OK. It sounds like a marriage made in heaven. Were there any snacks?
Not really. There was a lot of preliminary work because we had to get these... we approached firms to produce sugar-free chocolate bars and sugar-free cake mixes and fruit which was canned in water and not in syrup. And we took, I don't know how many tons of food with us, but I mean, it was really quite a major effort to get the show on the road and get all this stuff packed up, and some of it was donated. Some companies... Beecham's in particular had an interest in, they make glucose, and had a great interest in trying to put glucose into foods, like Glucozade and things like that. So they gave us a lot of the food. It was quite interesting.
We're talking about the mid-60s, aren't we, here, when you were doing your basic research. So what was the timetable? Once you got British Antarctic Survey to agree, was it at that point that you have to start gathering and creating all this specialist food?
Yes, all the the medical research program was supervised in the main by the Division of Human Physiology of the Medical Research Council. We were nominally under their control anyway, So they had considerable resources to help.
Right. So, but at the same time, you had to apply to be a medical officer. You had to go through the FIDS.
Yes, I'd done that, but that seemed to be pretty much a formality because they needed doctors. Yes. I don't think they were overburdened with applications.
So the interview was a cinch, was it?
Well, it was quite interesting. It was an interview with one man, the great
that?
Bill Sloman, who you know heard about.
So I'm interested by the mechanics of all this. So eventually you had to get all this stuff on the dockside somewhere, didn't you?
Yes.
All this food.
But we, you know, you've got a date, so it's easy to do it, but you know there's a date beyond which you can't go, because if you miss a ship, you've had it.
And this was going to be you were sailing in the autumn of 67?
That's right.
Late autumn of 67. On which ship?
On the Perlidan.
From?
Southampton.
With all this food?
Yes.
And did you know which base you were going to go to?
Yes. Yes, we knew it was Halley Bay, partly because I needed to have enough people to be able to do the experiment and have a control group and that sort of thing.
You were a brave man, weren't you? Because you're going to see a bunch of FIDS and try to tell them what to eat.
Well, look, FIDS have put up with quite a lot from their doctors at one time and another, because most of them, not quite all, but most medical officers did have research programs, and they mostly either involved feeding them and they had a lot of blood taken from them. I think I was stabbing them every 2 weeks for blood samples.
Having not been particularly keen about going to the Antarctic, what did he make of it when he got there?
Well, I don't think I wasn't keen to go. I hadn't gone because of a burning desire to go to the Antarctic.
You were the odd man out. You weren't that bothered.
Well, not initially, no. Yeah. Well, no, it grows on you very quickly, of course, when you're on the way down. Although, of course, going on the Perlidan, you're very much a passenger rather than on the Bass ships where you're working the ships. So really we had quite a luxurious trip down, but then when we got to the Falklands and South Georgia on the way into the Weddell Sea, it grows on you.
Oh really? You were impressed with
it? Yes, very.
So you arrived at Halley and presumably had to get involved in the relief.
Well, you're just one of the base once you get there, and that's right. So it was a couple of weeks, and of course the new base was really just being occupied. I suppose it's Halley 2, I suppose, Grillage Village. So we moved into what effectively was a brand new base. So that was interesting too.
A luxurious medical area?
Well, it was quite good, really, yes.
Was there a surgery as such? Or
There was. There was a dedicated room, which I used as an office, but also was... Yeah. Oh, yes. No, I mean, it wasn't terribly rugged indoors, anyway.
Yeah, sounds good. What was the first step, then? Because you had to presumably... at some point, you had to persuade the FIDS to eat what you wanted them to eat, and you had to persuade the cooks to cook it and so on. So was there a certain amount of détente required early on?
Yeah, so with no great objection. Nobody objected. And they had also other things as well. I mean, they had to weigh them. So one of the problems, if you stop people eating sugar, they immediately lose weight. So we wanted to make sure they ate as much glucose as possible to their weight. So we needed their weight to be steady so that the changes in lipids wasn't due to changes in weight. So they had to weigh themselves every day with nothing on. Some of them wouldn't do that, but most of them did.
Was there any other kind of resistance apart from the underpants?
No, not really. Some people didn't like having their blood taken, but they got used to it. Mm.
So talk me through a typical day's menu.
Well, the menu was pretty much the same. I mean, we'd gone to great lengths to manufacture the sort of foods which you would normally eat. It's just they didn't have any sugar in them and they had glucose instead. It gave the cooks a bit of a challenge. The biggest problem was the granulated sugar, such as you might have put into your tea, became granulated glucose. Mm. And it's not so soluble as ordinary sugar. So a teaspoonful of glucose on the end, and you put it into your tea and stir it and pull it out, and there's a great gob on the end of the spoon where it hasn't dissolved. So, but people were very good. But I mean, if they wanted toast and jam, they had toast and jam, but the toast was made without any, I mean, the bread was made without any sugar in it, and the jam didn't have any in either. It was made with glucose.
Was it your job to actually show the chefs what to do?
Well, we discussed it, and it was pretty much trial and error, because I hadn't done any cooking with it, and I knew what the limitations would be. They were very good, and everybody joined in, and
there weren't any secret supplies.
Well, as you've probably heard from others, on the basis, everybody is helping everybody else with their various programs. So I think mine was just another program. Some of them were a bit cynical about it, but they all joined in.
Well, let's talk about what you found. What conclusions did you start to come to whilst you were down there, or when you got back?
Well, none at all while I was there. I came back with a vast array of frozen serum samples, which I spent a couple of years analysing after I got back. But it showed that people who had got high lipid levels, whilst they were on the diet, those levels came down. But people who'd got sort of normal levels, it didn't really have much effect on.
Was that what you were hoping or expecting? Or?
Well, we didn't really know what to expect, but yes, it was. We were hoping to see some changes. Mm. But that was, 40 years ago, and I think it was a burning interest then, but like lots of medical things, history has shown it's probably not important.
So it wasn't... Your findings were not adapted and adopted in any way?
No, they were... I published them in suitably prestigious medical journals, but like lots of research, I don't think now you would pick it out as a seminal piece of work.
But it must have been satisfying at the time, too.
Oh, yes, yes, it was.
Do the work and find it was...
Yes.
Your theories were proven.
No, it certainly was.
Yeah. Anything else to talk about on that subject, or should we move on to other things?
No, I think that's about it so far as...
So did you find your other skills as a doctor being called into play? Were you...
Well, my medical skills? Mm. Very little, really. The two major medical problems that occurred in the Antarctic that year, the first was the cook at Argentine Islands, where there wasn't a doctor, who developed a very nasty illness. And you've probably heard others talking about him, and he subsequently died, although not... have you...
Please, I'd like you to sum up the story, if you can, please. Yeah.
Well, he developed a condition called ulcerative colitis, although it wasn't known what the condition was. The base, round about midwinter, the base commander at the Argentine Islands, I think it was John Dewdney at the time, reported that the cook appeared to be pretty sick. And this was mainly dealt with by the medical officer at Stonington, because he was nearer and they were in better... But he was a bit puzzled by what was going on, so he and I used to discuss the problem, and it became pretty apparent this guy was really sick. And, of course, there was no doctor at Argentine Islands, and even had there been, I don't think they had any medication that would have helped. Hence, really, my later interest in medical stores. And there was a big international effort. The Chileans, from one of their bases, flew a doctor. And this was pretty much at midwinter, although Argentine Islands is a little bit further north. But they flew a light aircraft in with a doctor on board and landed on the sea ice and managed to give the patient a few pints of blood. And then we're going to fly him back to their base because that was nearer where a ship could be got in. But unfortunately, the plane crashed. It was trying to take off, and although nobody was, I think, badly hurt, the plane was, and so there they were stuck. And the Argentinians, in the meantime, had taken an icebreaker out of its winter or its annual refit and started ploughing their way down until eventually they could helicopter the patient off. And they actually got him back to Buenos Aires, but he died not long after that. So all this was going on at a base with no doctor at all. But the rest of us were fairly involved in sort of radio schedules, trying to work out what was going on.
Was this daily contact?
It was pretty much at the time. Mm-hmm. And I can't... the time scale can only have been a few weeks, but I really don't remember exactly what the time scale was. And it wasn't going on for months and months. So that was one medical thing. So I we're only involved by radio.
Was that frustrating for you to be not on the scene?
Well, it was very concerning, although in fact there might well have been not an awful lot that could have been done, even had there been a medical officer on the base.
Do you remember the Fitz's name?
who died was Ken Portwine, I think his name was. And the other one was one of our own people at Halley Bay, Nick Matthews, who broke his leg while he was skiing in the Shackleton Mountains, 400 miles from base. And we were faced, or I was faced, with the problem of... We ascertained by radio that he'd probably broken his leg, and fortunately the sledging stores had got plaster of Paris bandages, and we'd practiced putting them on during the winter. So he had the wherewithal to plaster his leg up, which he did. But the question then was, what do we do with him? And I consulted, of course, in those days communications was pretty terrible, but we sent signals back to London, looking for guidance really about whether to get him out. But getting him, so we had a reply from Sir Vivian Fuchs saying, if you as the medical officer think he should be extracted, we'll do it, but of course it will ruin the Americans' summer program, it will ruin our own, we'll have to bring everybody out of the mountain, we'll finish our field season, but you're the guy on the ground, and if you think it's necessary, we'll do it. Which I didn't think was very helpful. But since Nick seemed fairly happy, and it didn't, you know, his foot was pointing the right way and it didn't hurt, so we left him there, and he eventually got back 5 weeks later, I think. Having, I think, in the meantime, he kept telling us by radio on our evening radio schedules that he was terribly worried that his plaster of Paris was getting soft and breaking down and the plaster cast was coming adrift. But when he got back, it was actually about an inch thick, and it nearly killed me trying to get it off. It was incredibly tough. But he did fine.
So when you got the plaster off, were you able to do an assessment?
Well, I x-rayed it.
Yeah. Oh, you x-rayed it, yes.
And then put him back in the plaster again.
Right. And he's still walking today, is he?
Oh, Nick's fine, yes. I don't know if he's coming this weekend.
So when you got to Halley, were your impressions of a sophisticated establishment or fairly rudimentary? How did you assess it when you arrived?
Well, I think Halley was, and probably still is, it was, I thought, quite sophisticated. I mean, the old IGY huts, which were still in use just, were pretty primitive, and of course by then were about 50 foot below the surface. I mean, they were really quite hazardous, but we were leaving them, and they seemed quite... But the new base... I mean, we had 24-hour electricity, we had plenty of heat, we had... I thought it was quite sophisticated.
Were you watching the men's psychology whilst you were there as well? Casual interest.
Yes, there's an interesting... or a few interesting points about FIDS and their psychology. I mean, the American bases, which have a Navy, or had, I don't know, but you still do have a Navy crew who run the base and then scientists who flew in and did their thing, had a history of having big personality problems on their bases. And in fact, I recall after I got back going to an Antarctic conference in Cambridge at which they measured the social success of their bases, the American bases, by the number of episodes of physical violence they had between base members. Well, most of us couldn't remember any episodes of physical violence. But I think it was partly because we all went down by sea, and I believe, although I had no personal experience, that occasionally someone was taken off in Stanley if they clearly didn't fit in or were going to be a problem. And it's probably partly the British character not to be a bit phlegmatic about life. So there was that. But, of course, the base did have, not psychological problems, but there were morale problems because as a result of the previous summer's field trip, I mean, the summer we went in, it became obvious that it was going to be very difficult to get to the Shackleton Mountains in order to do a survey, which was the basis of the whole of the summer, next summer's field trip. And as a result, the BAS office in London cancelled the next summer's field programme. Well, that, of course, caused a terrible loss of morale, particularly amongst all the field staff, the geologists and the people who should have gone out to the field. And there was an enormous amount of work done to try and put together a programme which was doable, which involved an enormous long vehicle trip just to get to the Mountain Solaire depots. And then eventually, with the help of the Americans, to fly people in, because we hadn't, up to then, had any help from the Americans like that. And then by the time the sort of middle of the winter and the autumn was coming on, when this was put in place, the morale then soared, because we then had an enormous field programme, which in the end was very successful. So it was interesting how morale changed during the year, but it was due to the circumstances which you've got very little control of, really.
Which is bad for morale, isn't
but it's
it?
Well, it's well written up in Peter Noble's book, which no doubt seen.
But how did it manifest itself? How did the FID's behaviour change when morale went down, then back up again?
Well, I think they just got slightly depressed. I mean, it wasn't just running the base keeps people busy, the routine and so on. So it wasn't as though people had got nothing to do and had time to sit and worry. In fact, they reacted really quite positively by trying to seek ways that they could put to London about how they could do the programme. But it wasn't a problem, but it was just a noticeable change of morale as the circumstances changed.
What sort of conditions or problems did they come to you with? I know it's a healthy place, the Antarctic, but were there one or two things that kept on cropping up as a GP, so to speak?
No, virtually nothing. I'd cut finger and things like that, but I probably did more work on the dogs we had than I did on humans.
How do you mean?
Well, the dogs were always biting each other and occasionally needed sewing up and that sort of thing, and... But I mean, we really had no episodes of ill health at all of any significance. I took a couple of teeth out, I think, but I didn't gain much medical experience.
Is there such a thing as midwinter blues? Did you spot that coming along at the time?
I don't think it was anything significant. I think people developed what was known as the FID stare, which you probably others may have told you about, where you'd find someone sitting at a table with his eyes focused on the middle distance, clearly not with it, lost in their thoughts, but it was always referred to, "Now, if you leave him alone, he's got the FID stare." But it was nothing significant.
What do you think's changed in the years since your time down there? What are the major... Or what were the significant changes taking place whilst you were there?
I don't think there were many changes while I was there, but I went back on the... Marguerite Bay cruise that a few FIDs organised about 5 years ago, and there are huge differences now.
Such as?
Well, communications is the main one. I mean, we, I think just about at times, had voice contact with Port Stanley. All communications with the UK, I think, were done by Morse code. It was all typed up into Morse code and put on a tape. And certainly, apart from we were allowed, I think, 100 words a month free, which we could send home, and we got, I think, 200 words back. But anything else had to be sent at, I think it was 1 and 10 a word as a telegram. So there really was no communications, whereas now you can pick up a satellite phone and...
phone home.
And presumably, and ring home. Mm. And there were no... I mean, now there are very few people winter there. I mean, we all had to winter. But now that they fly people in far more, and there's a much bigger flying programme now, and that's strikingly different. And I mean, Halley Bay was the biggest base. There were only 30 of us there, but it was the biggest British base. But if you go to Rothera, I think when we were there, there are 120 people there. I mean, it's a different world.
Do you think that the nature of FIDs has changed as well? Because... in your day, you did go down on the boat together, you did spend the winter there, you came back on the boat together. So when you meet at reunions, you've got lots to talk about, whereas the more recent FIDs who are flying there, only spending a few weeks or months there, they're coming back again. It's more of a day job for them, isn't it, really?
I think it must be, although I must confess I haven't had a lot of contact with recent FIDs. Certainly those of us who were there 40 years ago keep in touch pretty regularly with each other, as you probably gathered from your... conversations with people. You certainly make firm friends.
Do the stories get better?
Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, that was one... the one downer, really, for me was the fact that I was... the doctors at Halybeard had a checkered history of problems. My predecessor had fallen over the ice cliff and had actually been the only major casualty of the year was the doctor, which was considered not to be very sensible, and he was involved in being rescued by the Americans. It was the first time the Americans had flown to Halybeard, and he had to be extracted before I got there. So, that was considered bad form for the doctor to be the casualty, and I think two or three seasons before I was there, the doctor was one of those who were killed in the crevasse accident at Halybeard. Okay. So they were pretty reluctant to let me leave the base, beyond a couple of days. Well, yes, I mean, I would have loved to have had the chance to get out in the field, but I mean, they really were quite bothered, I think, about the fact that that I shouldn't be hazarded.
So you didn't do any sledging or such?
Well, I did, but only locally around the base. But I didn't get away for any substantial time or to anywhere particularly interesting, which was all right. I mean, I'm not a desperately rugged person.
Well, you have to be fairly rugged to survive a winter in the Antarctic, don't you?
Well,
minus 50 indoors.
Well, it wasn't minus 50 indoors. It may have been outside.
Do you think... what about the changes in bureaucracy? I mean, I guess... Because there was no communication, ergo there was very little bureaucracy in those days.
Well, it certainly seems different. Again, I have no recent experience, but I mean, Bass was, in those days, run by, I think, four or five people in Victoria Street or Wilton Street. I mean, Sir Vivian Fuchs, there was Bill Sloman and I think one other personnel, and there was Derek Gipps with a couple of people helping him, and that was it. Whereas there's apparently an enormous bureaucracy in Cambridge. But of course all the academic departments, which were scattered around, I think are now all concentrated in Cambridge, so it's perhaps not as big as it seems.
Were you surprised at the time at the way the environment was being used, or should I say abused, that animals were being killed with food and waste was not being particularly carefully taken care of, or did it just seem normal in those days?
It seemed pretty normal, and I think that rather overmuch is made of the problem now. It seems incredible to me that they have to bring all the waste back with them. I really, when you see the vast size of the Antarctic and the minute footprint of humans on it, I really have difficulty in thinking of the huge efforts that now go into... looking after the environment are really necessary.
There were a couple of incidents you wanted to talk about. One was dropping a vehicle onto a roof or something along those lines.
Well, I think you asked whether it was an amusing incident, and whilst the field parties and most of the mechanics were out in the field, the new base, Halley 2, Grillage Village, had only recently been covered with snow. It was below the surface, but not very much, and somebody drove a vehicle rather close to it, and it sort of collapsed through onto the roof, which was a cause of much photograph-taking and hilarity, and some concern, I think, on the part of the base commander, and a bit of ingenuity to move it without damaging the building. But I suppose I remember it, because everybody took photographs of it and still show them with pride. It wasn't a huge incident, but... certainly caused a lot of mirth.
Most of the FIDs I talk to regard their time in the Antarctic as being a very special part of their life, a kind of a memorable episode. Would you go along with that? Or?
Well, yes, and it totally changed my life because I got... my medical experience was pretty slight. I'd qualified, done my house jobs, had taught anatomy for a year and then got involved in this physiological project and... But got very interested in the problems of people working in really very adverse conditions. I mean, poor old carpenter trying to work outside at minus 30 and things, that's quite interesting. So I got very interested in the problems of people in the workplace. And when I came back, I changed tack completely and became an occupational physician. Spent the rest of my life working in industry, totally concerned with the effects of people's work on their health. And... So, yes, it did make a huge difference to me.
What conclusion did you come to about the poor old FIDs and their the way their environment, their work environment, affected their health?
Well, it didn't really. But, well, they adapted. But not everybody adapts like fish. There's a reason why most people become fins. They are adaptable, I think. And the other, and of course, I also got interested in the problems of the medical stores. We had this illness at Argentine Islands where, as I say, had there been a doctor there, probably he wouldn't have had the wherewithal to treat the patient anyway. And so there was considerable concern in the Bass headquarters that we should revise the scale of medical stores so that all bases would have exactly the same, whether or not they had a doctor. And there were other side issues, like most drugs have got use-by dates, like most food. And because of the long time in packing up and sending things to the Antarctic, many of them were out of date before they ever got there, which concerned people a lot. But, like most food, probably didn't matter much. And so, as I say, after I got back, I spent the next several years really just on a very part-time basis collecting what the various doctors said about the other base personnel about the medical stores, and we revised them a number of times over the next 5 or 6 years.
Were you listened to?
Oh, I mean, what I said, yes. I mean, I eventually, the scales of stores which were sent were constructed by me. The latter ones, in consultation with other doctors who'd been there.
So when you arrived there and you opened the medical kit, were you surprised at how meager it was?
I knew what was coming. We were given lists of what was coming, and also as the doctors were given the opportunity to add to it if they wanted to.
What was missing that you what did you miss most when you opened your?
Well, nothing, because I had no illnesses to treat.
Right.
But this case at Argentine Islands made everybody think. It would have been impossible to give a blood transfusion, for instance. You don't have any collecting bags to collect blood in to give people. But I've no idea what I mean. I haven't seen present scale of equipment since the late 1970s.
So in your advisory role, when you're advising about what to add to the stores, once you come back and you were giving advice to Bass, what were you putting into the kit that hadn't been there before?
Well, there were a few not terribly sophisticated drugs which might have helped the Argentine Islands, which were pills that were not expensive and could be put in, although it was very unlikely you'd use them. I mean, it was a unique case. But had you had them, you might have been able to do a bit more to help. Mm. And it was on that sort of basis that we started putting in, and I don't think I can give you examples, but starting adding medication for unusual conditions, just in case they arose, as an insurance policy. But over the years, there's been very little illness in the Antarctic. I mean, most people of that age group are pretty fit anyway. Mm. And most accidents were either fatal or not, or pretty trivial.
You say that then the Antarctic experience changed your work pattern for the future, but in what way do you think the Antarctic experience changed you as a person?
Oh, it's hard to tell. I suppose I learned how to get on with shut up with a group of people for a year, but maybe I could have done that anyway. We certainly made very good friends, many of whom are here this weekend.
So does it have a special place in your heart?
Yes. Well, the other thing is, I spent most of my time while I was down there thinking to myself, well, it is a daft thing to do. I mean, I've got my piece of research going, but all my friends at home, my medical colleagues, will be getting all the good jobs. But when I got back, I discovered that I was the only one who'd done anything different, and it certainly wasn't any hindrance to me.
It was good that you're on your CV, was it?
To have taken a year out and done no medical work, as it were.
Why do you come back to the reunions? Is it just for old time's sake, or is it...
Well, I like to see the guys who I only meet once, or in some cases, twice a year.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed.